Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Annie Watson, and welcome back to another episode of R is Sorare. This is season 2, episode 1, and this is an interview I did with Dr. Howard Berman, who is the CEO of Coya Therapeutics. Coya Therapeutics is a therapeutics and like pharmaceuticals company that is working to create different types of therapies and treatments for disorders and diseases affected by inflammation or like autoimmune disorders that affect the Treg cells of our bodies and our brains. So one of the treatments they are working on right now and getting approved is one for ALS, which is Lou Gehrig's disease. So it's really cool. He is an amazing and very humble guy. It was really cool to talk to him and see what he had to say about his company, where he has come from and where he's gotten so far, and just to see the hope he has for his company and the people who work for him, and just the fact that he is doing such amazing things in the therapeutics realm of ALS. It's fascinating, and I definitely enjoy talking to Howard. I will leave all of Howard and Coya Therapeutics' information in the show notes below. So be sure to check out their website and check out my Instagram post for more information on Howard. Be sure to subscribe to R is Sorare on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to follow me on Instagram at R is Sorare Podcast. Without further ado, let's get into the episode.
Hi, Dr. Howard. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Call me Howard, please.
Oh, okay. So Howard, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you are in your life right now, what you do, and your like involvement in the rare disease community, and a fun fact about yourself.
Oh, well, where am I? I am, first of all, thanks for having me on your podcast. It's amazing what you're doing. I'm a PhD by background. I studied at Cornell, and I spent my career in the pharmaceutical industry developing new drugs for terrible diseases like cancer and neurodegenerative conditions. And what's inspiring to me is the ability to make meaningful differences in patients who have no other options and unfortunately have limited amounts of therapeutic interventions. And you know, where I am is we all have family members who have been struck by these sorts of diseases. So it's very personal in being at Coya and in developing these therapeutics and these drugs to make meaningful change and a meaningful difference in people's lives. And, you know, one day it's potentially going to help my own father, or it's going to help myself, or it's going to help many people that desperately need these new treatments. That's the vision that we live every single day at Coya.
It's amazing. And then, that's awesome. How did you get started going from developing new drugs as your PhD specialization to being at Coya and being the head of it all as the CEO?
Yeah. Well, that was an evolution. It doesn't happen overnight, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And one has to... There's lots of barriers, and there's many steps that one has to take in order to get to this position, this point. But the bottom line is I learned very early on, if you're not doing it, then sometimes it just doesn't get done. And I realized that in order to attack and to challenge the paradigm of diseases, one has to think outside the box. And I came across an incredible technology in my previous work with the pharmaceutical industry. Just so happened to meet a very incredible person in Dr. Stan Appel, and I saw his research, and I was so taken aback by the clinical work that he'd done and the proof of concept data that he had, that he asked me, can I help spearhead this and take this on? And I said, absolutely. And with that, I quit everything else that I was doing to launched this vision and this mission to treat these patients. And the first disease that we started off with was something called ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease. And it's a very important mission to try and either slow or stop the disease from progressing because these patients go so fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's incredible. I know from personal experience, I had a family member who passed away from ALS, but so I know kind of firsthand the effect that that can take on a person. And along with ALS, are there other, what are the other like neurodegenerative diseases that you guys focus on, and autoimmune as well, that you focus on in your research and in your applications, I guess, at Coya?
Sure. Well, there's frontotemporal dementia, which is a form of dementia that usually strikes people younger than the typical the later stage Alzheimer's. It's more progressive. There's Parkinson's, there's other multiple sclerosis and other diseases like that that are driven by inflammation. And autoimmune, which is also driven by inflammation and regulatory T cell dysfunction of regulatory T cells, which I can explain a little bit more in detail. There's diseases like lupus and scleroderma, which are very horrible for many patients with very few treatment paradigms that are actually working. And so our goal here is to shift the paradigm from where things have been to where things are going. And that's what we're doing in our three modalities and platforms that we're working on.
Mm-hmm. And what exactly are T cells? Like, how does that affect the way our body works, our brain works, how we process and react to these types of diseases like dementia, Parkinson's, lupus? How does that affect it? And how, what is your current research right now on how to target those?
Well, we are focused. So there are T cells come in many different types. And people typically think of T cells being involved in attacking viruses and also helping in combat disease. We're focused on not the effector T cells, those CD8 T cells, for instance, but we're focused on a type of CD4 T cell called a regulatory T cell. The regulatory T cell, in fact, blocks inflammation. It doesn't enhance it. It suppresses inflammation. So it's the exact opposite of what the other T cells are doing. And unfortunately, when you have a T cell, regulatory T cell, that's not working properly, you don't have the ability to block inflammation, and the inflammatory cascade, the whole inflammation in the body goes out of whack, and it causes many of these diseases to dramatically progress much quicker. And so our goal here, and based on the discovery that it's the dysfunctional regulatory T cells that are contributing to the decline of patients and the survival of patients in these many diseases that I've discussed, like neurodegenerative and autoimmune. And so what we're doing is we're taking in three different platforms. One is in T cell autologous T cell therapies. We're taking the T cells and we're enhancing the T cells, the regulatory T cells becoming functional, and we're readministering it back to the patients. But we're also doing two other platforms with what are called exosomes, which are the vesicles inside the cells, so they're not actually cells, but we're isolating the secret sauce, the components of the cells. And then finally, we have agents and biologics that one could inject into the body that can enhance Treg function without needing any sort of cell therapy. And all of those ultimately end up enhancing the function of regulatory T cells.
Mm-hmm. That's quite impressive. And how exactly do this, how does your goal of shifting the paradigm and trying to focus on this exact science, I guess, at Coya, I guess it is science because it is scientifically based, Treg cells or regulatory T cells, sorry.
You can call them Tregs.
Tregs, there we go. How does that look logistically? Like, how do you go from that goal and that science that you have narrowed down your mission to be at Koya, if so to say. How does that look logistically? Not necessarily an everyday insight into it, but how does that look on paper and logistically at Koya Therapeutics?
Okay, so from like a manufacturing standpoint, how is it done? So
yeah.
We, for instance, on the cell therapy side, a patient would fly in to our facility. We would take their blood, like a traditional blood sample, what's called an apheresis, and then we would isolate their Tregs, and we would then, using bioreactors in our GMP facility, we would expand the Tregs. And after about 10 days, 12 days at the most, we would have super functional Tregs, all while the patient's already back home and flown home and is waiting on the therapy. And within the 10 or 12 days, we have 3 billion functional Tregs, which we're able to freeze. And then we're able to then administer on a monthly basis in the various dosages that we've figured out. And at the same time, we're able to produce the exosomes, about trillions of the exosomes, from the same process, and we're able to freeze those and then administer them. Now, this time we don't have to administer it back to the same patient. The goal is to administer it to anyone so that you don't have to match it patient for patient, because they're not cells, they're vesicles. And that's the allogeneic exosome, Treg exosomes. And so those are the mechanisms by which we logistically can accomplish this. And then thirdly is we have biologics, which are manufactured the way typical biologics are manufactured. And those are typically off the shelf, and it can be administered just as an monoclonal antibody can.
Okay. And then, so your you listed as the therapies, the cell therapies, so to say, the exosome isolation and the biologics, the first of those being almost a personalized type of treatment, correct?
That's correct. The first one is the cell therapy, and it's matched patient for patient. So the patient gives the cells, donates the cells, and the patient receives their own cells back. So there's no rejection. That's called autologous. Okay. That means that just like in cancer therapy, in CAR T therapy, every patient receives their own cells back. That's what we're doing for the Koya 101, which is the first modality in ALS with cell therapy. The exosomes are not autologous. They're allogeneic, which means that you can harvest, if you will, exosomes from normal healthy donors, and you can do it much more scalable. And then you can administer, the thought is to administer to anyone to receive those exosomes.
Okay. And how has the what does the success, quote unquote, success rate look like for those different types of treatments? Because you have almost an umbrella of conditions and disorders that you're able to tackle, like we mentioned earlier, and you have this almost three-part, we have the three modalities, as you've said. How is that looked out? How is that played out for your patients?
Well, I think we've run now 2 clinical trials in the autologous cell therapy, a phase 1 and a phase 2A. Mm-hmm. And we're extremely excited about the results. The phase 1 was a small number of patients, but we completely stopped the progression of ALS patient decline. The phase 2A, which was a little bit larger cohort, we stopped the progression in, I would say, about half of the patients, and slowed it in a good number additional. The ones that the patients that actually declined relatively quickly, we identified biomarkers indicative of oxidative stress and inflammation that were far out of whack and were many standard deviations above the norm. So we're going to use those biomarkers to help stratify, to enrich for the patients who will respond in the next trial.
Okay, that's amazing. And are you doing a lot of collaboration work, as you said, with biomarkers? I'm assuming like the geneticists would be involved. Like how many scientists are you working with?
Well, that's the beautiful thing is that you don't need geneticists in this case. We only need a typical blood sample, and you can measure, you can quantify it just from specific laboratory analysis, whether their markers are high at baseline. So you measure their markers. If it's extremely high, then you say, you know what? I think their inflammatory environment may not be conducive for the cells to go back into the patient.
Okay. That's fascinating. I'm also not necessarily a science based. My mind is not conducive to science, and I am learning so much right now. And this is just fascinating to me that a simple blood test can do so much. Because also, speaking from experience, also part of how I found out that I have my condition, which is narcolepsy. And it's just fascinating that the human blood can tell you so much about certain conditions. It's mind blowing to me. What are some of the things you've learned from others in your field of work, whether it's like basic workplace life lessons or just scientific specific to your work? What have you learned as you've done both your work at Coya and also just with your PhD in general? Like, what have you learned since you started this journey at Coya?
Well, it's a great question. I would say passion, have passion for what you do. Go all out. Don't do anything halfway. Be meaningful and be sensitive to all the conditions and everyone else around you. And try and imbue your sense of vision and spirit into everyone else around you and get them excited as to what your vision is. If you can do all of that, you can create an incredible organization and you can really provide, I think, an important stepping stone to all the financial and corporate work can be very complicated. And so if you're not fully committed, invested in it, it's going to be a long road. So if you can really get behind it in terms of the vision and the importance, then it all becomes worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible. And as you said, like, they can be quite difficult. What are some of the roadblocks and any difficulties you have come across in this very extensive and very intense line of work? Are there any difficulties you have come across, and how have you gone past those?
Sure. Well, I would say the biggest roadblock, I think the biggest barriers are people always telling you no. People saying you can't do that, or it's too difficult. And if you get one door or two doors or three doors shut in your face, you can't get discouraged. Mm-hmm. And inherently, as being a CEO of a company, raising money, working on very hard issues and and answering difficult questions, scientific questions specifically, and being able to address that, you have to get used to that. And once you're okay with that and you're okay with ambiguity, I think ultimately then you can do anything you want to do. And no one ever told Elon Musk that it was going to be easy to accomplish what he did, or Steve Jobs, but they did it because they had a big grand vision. And I have a vision, you know, call it an altruistic vision, but it's something really meaningful, is to help these patients. If you see these patients with neurodegenerative conditions declining without anything to help or to assist, it really makes everything worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's incredible. Kind of shifting towards you yourself and your job, like just like the everyday workings of your job. What do you like most about being the CEO of Coya? And what, if you want to answer this question, what do you like least?
Well, what I don't really care about, let me start off with that, is the title. I don't really care about being called a CEO or being the chief executive officer or the chairman of the board. That doesn't, the name or the title means nothing to me. And that's the neutral. What I love about it is waking up every day knowing that new data is coming in and seeing if we're making meaningful differences for these patients, is hearing the stories from patients all around the country and their hope and their excitement for what we're doing. And that's very exciting. It's literally living the future of medicine in real time, knowing that potentially one of the treatments that we have could be groundbreaking and could stop the progression or even improve patients. That, to me, there's nothing better than that. Mm-hmm. What can be challenging and what can be difficult is knowing this is a very capital intensive business. It requires lots of money for research and development, and that's complicated. And so one has to feel comfortable with the knowledge that more money, even when you've raised money, you're going to need more money. And so putting on the financial hat, which I never learned in my PhD training, but subsequently I have, fortunately, is always looking ahead to funding the company and knowing that we have enough money in the bank to accomplish our goals.
Mm-hmm. And how have you, like, do you like tell people or like let people know that like this in like not your verbal like everyday exchanges, but even just like in the way you act in the company, do you make it known that you feel like the title of CEO is somewhat arbitrary? Like, how do you, because I feel like just from this 20-minute conversation, I was not surprised at all by what you said because of this, your mannerisms and the way you've brought yourself on, which is just complimentary, by the way. But in the past 20 minutes, like, it's just because you seem like you're very humbling yourself towards your job, which is, it's astounding, by the way. How do you like let that on? Because I feel like the title of CEO, especially nowadays, when, like you said, capital is what drives all of these things nowadays, and needing money to fund things, whether it's Koya or whatever other company you want to list off the top of your head. But I feel like the title of CEO has, no matter what company you're talking about, has kind of, the public eye has changed regarding that title. So how do you in your everyday life try to remove that type of like barrier around your title, if that makes any sense?
Wow, what a question. It's a great question. But let me go back and, you know, talk to those people who say, how can you blend this important mission to help patients with the idea of making money, going on to create a for-profit capital endeavor? I'll say those two have to be married in order to be successful. The only way in a capital society, the only way to actually make meaningful differences is by having a for-profit company, because that's the only way that you're going to attract money to fund your ventures. A nonprofit endeavor, a nonprofit venture would not be able to raise enough money to get to where you want to go. So I just want to, some people are thinking maybe, how is that all compatible with each other? And that's how it's compatible. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, I'm just trying to go back to your other question. I think the bottom line at being a CEO is someone has to do it. Someone has to be at the top to make hard and difficult decisions. But if I don't do it, who will do it and who will do it well? If I'm the most passionate person about it, then I need to be the one who leads the way. And that's the mm-hmm. way that I look at things. And you know, ultimately, in the process, you hire people, but you got to treat everyone with respect. You have to be very delicate and very sensitive to other people's feelings and emotions, and just make sure that you run an organization that's built on professionalism and trust. And so the way that I tell no one to call me the CEO. They call me Howard, and it's a very horizontal structure. It's not a vertical structure. Mm-hmm. And that's different than how these large companies work and big pharma. There's a lot of vertical bureaucracy, and I would never want to work in that sort of environment.
Mm-hmm. And I think that creates almost, like you said, you want to be the most passionate person in the room, because otherwise who else is going to be in charge? And I think that that's just a great way to look at something as almost delicate in a way as medical companies, as therapeutics, as pharmaceuticals, because I feel like a lot of like the general public and also the rare disease community, I feel like a lot of our like issues with things not getting covered and just medication in general is it all leads back to big pharma. Because at the, like, it's just their horse, the way that they've already taken hold, and it's just almost, it's not necessarily too late, but it's very hard. And I think you, in order to be focusing on the people while also focusing on profits, like you, and you and your company have done what it looks like so far, from all I can tell. And it, the horizontal structure, it's almost like necessary, I feel like, with medicine, because if you do vertical, it turns too much into a political game. And that's not necessarily what anybody in who's trying to receive these treatments, that's not what they're looking for. And I think from my basic understanding of the horizontal versus vertical bureaucratic structure, I almost certainly would prefer a medical company to have a horizontal structure because of the way you play that delicate balance of the people and the workplace and your colleagues and coworkers and employees and the people you're serving and the money at the same time. And you play that delicate balance very well. So as a consumer, that would be preferable, but obviously not everyone's going to do that. But I think that that's just the perfect way, in my head at least, that a medical company can make everyone happy. I know that that's not the goal in any way, shape, or form, but to make the most people wanting your product and wanting to know more about medical companies. That's just my takeaway from that. So.
Well, I think big pharma has a bad reputation in general because of the amount of profits that big pharma has made over the years. And small biotech is very different. Small biotech is, you know, you roll up your sleeves, you bootstrap everything, and it's a very different environment. Ultimately, you know, pharma plays an important role. Without big pharma, I'll tell you, many of the innovations that have been developed would never have been developed without them. So there is an important role for pharma and all the money that they do have. And so, you know, ultimately, what we strive to do is to, you know, I think as we develop this and we generate new exciting clinical data, is to collaborate, see if pharma wants to work with us, because they have a tremendous amount of reach in terms of being able to develop and really spread what we're doing to, you know, not just the United States, but to many other countries, of which it costs a lot of money to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And kind of that, you provided a great segue for my next question. What are, if you do have any plans to eventually make this an international endeavor, if that is your goal, how would you go about that? And if you have plans, what are they?
Sure. Well, we are, of course, not centric to the United States or North America. The issues, neurodegeneration, and autoimmune is everywhere. So people all around the world have these disorders. So our goal is to launch initially with North America, of course, and the United States as the initial geography and jurisdiction. But, you know, we certainly want to expand, and we're talking to people in Europe as well as into Asia and Japan. And we have every intention to be able to bring out particularly our allogeneic exosomes and the biologics into a much broader population, which you can do, by the way, because these products have, from a logistical standpoint, can be shipped and thawed and frozen and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And how has the, as I'm thinking of like shipping and because of the vaccines, the COVID vaccines, those, I remember back when those first were like regulated, or not necessarily regulated, but like approved for emergency use, everybody was freaking out about how logistically you can make sense of that internationally, or at least even within the States, because of needing to freeze it and at a certain temperature. And how has the somewhat logistical success of that, has that helped you gain any more insight into what could potentially happen in the future? Like, what type of response did you have to the somewhat logistical success of the COVID vaccine?
Yeah. Well, I think what we're doing with respect with the exosomes and the biologic, the good thing is that they are very stable and they can be shipped and they can be frozen. They don't even have to be frozen at the degree that the mRNA vaccines can be frozen. I think some of those vaccines have to be frozen at very cold temperatures. Our therapeutics can just be under, you know, with typical freezing conditions. Mm-hmm. And so it makes shipping much easier. And logistically, there are many companies now that have tremendous amounts of experience in being able to ship from country to country under proper conditions and having the chain of the product, making sure that it's there's no break in terms of the temperature conditions. So we're very confident in terms of that. Autologous cell therapies are different. The personalized therapeutics need to be done on site. And so that makes scalability for autologous cell therapy somewhat limited in terms of the scalability or the challenge of it. So there are a number of considerations, but we're very bullish in the ability to scale this worldwide.
Mm-hmm. That's impressive. That's incredible. Kind of going back to some of the questions I provided before this interview, as a CEO, it's your title, I have to, but as your position, as your CEO position of Coya Therapeutics, what fascinates you most about rare diseases and disorders?
What fascinates me is how much limited information is known about them and the lack of research that's gone into it. And at the same time, how much we've learned in the last few years and what we can do to potentially challenge the paradigm in an area where people have just notoriously been having lack of treatment. That's what, to me, what's fascinating, but it's so overwhelmingly exciting to be able to be developing something that can really make a meaningful difference in these patients' lives. What we've seen with our Treg cell therapy really has never been seen before in the orphan disease called ALS. And I'm just saying, this is just one example where stopping the disease from progressing, you just typically doesn't go hand in hand with when you say the name ALS. And most diseases, for instance, I mean, most drugs now being tested only make a small or maybe even a modicum of difference in slowing the progression. And there's, you know, not a lot of excitement in terms of the therapeutics that are in clinical trials now. But I think what we have here really is going to change the paradigm. We're going to be publishing another paper coming out soon in the biomarkers as well as the phase 2A data. And I really think it's going to start creating a conversation that's going to be important for the community.
That's amazing. And after phase 2 of your clinical trials, what's next for the therapies that were in phase 1 and phase 2? What's next?
We're going to run a phase 2B study, which is going to be run out of California. We're our manufacturing facility there. We're going to run a large number of patients. We have to run a double-blind placebo-controlled trial. It's required by the FDA, but it will help delineate and differentiate that our therapy truly does make a difference and does work when you compare it to patients who are not receiving the therapy. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, at the end of the six-month double-blind portion, we're going to open this up for patients who were on placebo and also patients who were on the drug to continue or to switch over onto the drug. And that way, everyone will have access to the therapy. And we're hoping that that will provide a meaningful statistical significant difference in improvement versus placebo. And that could serve as the basis for an application for an approval.
That's amazing. And how does this play out for things like Medicaid and insurance? Like, do you know what that would look like for the, not like everyday consumer, but you know what I mean? With like the somewhat everyday, quote unquote, everyday person with ALS
or any of the other conditions you hope to treat that you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, how does that look in regards to like insurance, or do we not know how that would affect yet?
We have a good understanding of it's called managed care and third party payers. I think with the cost of manufacturing, and I think we have enough room to price this at an affordable rate that would be affordable, let's call it affordable by the standards of Medicare and private insurances. And it's based on what is currently charged by an approved drug that's on the market now that doesn't really do very much, but we would price it around that. We're not going to go significantly above or below that. And when you look at, if we're slowing or if we're stopping the disease from progressing, if you can imagine the patients that are progressing, ultimately they're suffering, but they're also, there's a lot of money being spent by Medicare and private insurance on taking care of those patients. It's called morbidity. It's the illness. It's how much time they're spending in the hospitals. And the patients are also dying very early. They're getting, there's just lots of interventions that need to occur. So we ultimately will save money for the system. Mm-hmm. But I think that's when it comes to dollars and cents. I think ultimately, if we can stop patients from dying or slow them significantly so that they have many more years with their loved ones, that's the goal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's better than anything. People would pay anything to save those that are going through such a terrible disease, such as ALS. I mean, at least from my perspective, I mean, I would pay any amount to try. You know, I realize money doesn't grow on trees, but if it means more time with someone you love who has mm-hmm. such a neurodegenerative disease, such as ALS, like if this ends up being the best option for them, you're already spending money on trying to do whatever you can. You might as well use this as well if it means stopping the disease altogether, which is amazing to say out loud. And I guess that's everyday work. Like, that must be amazing to be able to say that that's potentially what the future of this therapy looks like, which is amazing. And I have no other words to say, but it's just amazing that that's going to happen again from someone who had a loved one who passed away from ALS. That is astounding that is in the works, and that mm-hmm. is, crossing our fingers, going to be approved. That's because that's going to shift the narrative of not only ALS, but a lot of these other rare diseases altogether, because people don't realize it's rare. I feel like, because it's talked about so much because it's synonymous with Lou Gehrig, and the ice bucket challenge from like 6 or 7 years ago. Like, ALS has kind of always been in the back burner, at least for like the everyday person. Mm-hmm. But I feel like this will end up elevating the narrative of people who have this or have similar conditions, where people don't realize that these options aren't just readily available. So I think that the work you're doing is, like I said, incredible and amazing, and every other positive adjective that I can think of.
Thank you.
Because of course, because it's saving lives. And it's impressive that this, I'm just surprised that this wasn't even out before. But it's incredible that hopefully it gets approved in the near future.
Thank you.
Of course. My last question for every single one of my guests is, why do you want to share your story?
Well, I want it to be known to patients, first and foremost, that there is hope and there is something coming that we're very excited about to treat these terrible diseases, starting with ALS. We've got a little bit of a ways to go to expand upon what we're doing, but from what we're seeing, I want the patients and the caregivers to know that really a revolution is coming, and that the days of these therapeutics, which make only small incremental improvements, I think we're getting close to the end of that. That's number one. Number two is, I want people out there to know more of our story, just regular people, and understand that, you know, we are we're but a small company, but we are emerging. And the more that people know about us and what we do, I think the more the presence that we have and the more value that we can obtain, bringing in big pharma and other companies who can support what we're doing. And I think that sort of domino effect, and it's like an avalanche, it's a snowball, and then it just builds up. And I think that's part of the dialogue that we're having, not just with you, but with others, is to really start sharing our mission and our vision. And it starts with one person, but then it expands to many others. And you're a very important person. We really appreciate you taking the time to learn our story. And I hope you're excited like we are.
Of course. Anytime. Any instance where the rare disease community is heightened and is affected positively, I'm going to take it. And thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to talk to you and to learn more about what it means to be you and to be in your shoes at Coya. So anytime, and thank you again for such an amazing opportunity. If anybody wants to learn more about Dr. Howard Berman, I will leave more info in the show notes, as well as a link to anything about Coya in the show notes and on the Instagram post on my Instagram. Thank you so much, Howard, for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure. And you have just a wonderful forum. And I'm grateful that you've had me on today.
Of course. To all my listeners out there, be sure to subscribe to R is for Rare wherever you get your podcasts, and follow me on Instagram at R is for Rare Podcast, and stay tuned for next week's episode. Bye, everyone.